Crisis number two. Abraham, it's necessary for you to separate yourself from your favorite nephew. Now, how do I get off saying that? Well, we'll test it. A nephew who was especially close to him by nature, as a possible heir. Now watch that one. As a possible heir and fellow believer. Let's take a look at Genesis chapter 13, the first 9 verses. So Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him, into the Negev. Now Abram was very rich in cattle and silver and gold, we've already seen that, and he journeyed on from the Negev as far as Bethel to a place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai, to a place where he had made an altar at the first, and there Abram called on the name of the Lord. And Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents, so that the land could not support both of them dwelling together. For their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's cattle and the herdsmen of Lot's cattle. At that time, and watch this sentence, at that time the Canaanites and the Perizzites dwelt in the land. Then Abram said to Lot, "Look, let there be no strife between you and me, and between your herdsmen and my herdsmen, for we are kinsmen. Is not the whole land before you? Separate yourself from me. If you take the left hand, then I will go to the right, or if you take the right hand, then I will go to the left." Now verse 2 in that brief reading tells us how rich was, and verse 5 lets us know that Lot too was very rich. It's not unlikely that God blessed him, this is Lot, with riches because he went with Abram. Let that sink in for just a moment. I might mention the principle that it is good being in good company. Remember what we find in Zechariah. Zechariah chapter 8, verse 23 reads this way. Well, let's read more than that. Let's read verses 20 through 23 of Zechariah chapter 8. It says here, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, people shall yet come, even the inhabitants of many cities. The inhabitants of one city shall go to another, saying, let us go at once to entreat the favor of the Lord and to seek the Lord of hosts. I am going. Many peoples and strong nations shall come to seek the Lord of hosts in Jerusalem and to entreat the favor of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, in those days, 10 men from the nations of every tongue shall take hold of the robe of a Jew, saying, let us go up with you, for we have heard that God is with you." At this stage of the chronology, Lot was with Abram. I strongly suspect that he was very much aware of the favor and grace that had been bestowed upon Abram, and he wasn't just about to cut loose. And it wasn't until those herdsmen began to argue, because they were both so rich, that there wasn't room in the land. That's a point or two here that it's worth taking note of. They were so rich together that the land was unable to let them live peaceably together. It appears, brothers and sisters, from the context that Lot, not Abram, and we'll see that in a moment, that Lot might have succumbed, in part at least, to the axiom which Paul told Timothy in 1 Timothy 6, 9, and 10. Now, we don't have to turn it up. I was going to do it, but you know what I'm talking about. That's the reference where Paul tells Timothy that the love of money is the root of all evil. Not money, but the love of it. Now, money can be resources of any kind. And we have a situation here where Lot and Abram have herdsmen that are at loggerheads against each other. Now, what do you think that was? Why do you think that was? We're told that the land wasn't able to take care of all of them. Now, what did Lot do? Nothing. Nothing. Not so with Abram. It's true that the problem started with the herdsmen. There's no question about that. We're told that very plainly. But it surely got to their masters. It had to get to their masters. It could not and was not isolated between the herdsmen. Lot had to hear about it, and Abram had to hear about it. Couldn't avoid it. It had to be that case because Abram would not have used the personal pronouns that he uses. In verse 8, by the way, Abram says, "Don't let this be between me and thee." So it got to the head house in both instances. So what about this unhappy situation for Abraham? In addition to his love for Lot, I suspect that sometimes we let slip the latter part of verse 7, which says simply, "And the Canaanite and the Perizzite dwelt in the land." Why was that there? I mean, it didn't add to the so-called argument between Abraham and Lot and their herdsmen. It was simply, as Brother Tom says, it's not here by accident. Those words are in there for a reason. It said that the Canaanite and the Perizzite dwelt then in the land. You know, it really made this quarrel quite dangerous. If they couldn't live and feed their flocks together, it heightened the very real possibility of their common enemy, the Perizzite and the Canaanite, attacking and plundering them separately. Now, I know that's speculation, but just think about it a moment. Their defenses, as it were, would be weakened considerably, and they would be made subject of a possible attack, or whatever word you want to use, on them being separate. Now, you can, and I'll use this terminology with a bit of fear and trepidation, you can bet your bottom dollar, and I think you understand what I'm saying, you can bet your bottom dollar that their neighbors, remember Abraham was a very, very strong, rich man, you can bet that their neighbors undoubtedly watched them, these two wealthy landowners, these two wealthy owners of huge herds. Their neighbors watched them very carefully. Because of the singularity of their religion and the likely sanctity they professed, notice would surely be taken of the quarrel which ensued, which would invite reproach not only on them, but on their God. This kind of internecine conflict gives the enemies of God ready occasion to blaspheme then and now. Now, when I say now, I want to make myself abundantly clear. We have been blessed with the truth, those of us who call ourselves Christadelphians, the brethren of Christ. But there has been and still continues in some quarters wrongful internecine warfare between certain units calling themselves Christadelphians. It's gotten less and less in recent years, I'm very pleased to say, but it still exists. And when it does exist, and you may have that right here, and pardon me, this is being taped, you may have it right here in Joplin, Missouri. What do your friends and neighbors think about it? What do our friends and neighbors in Richmond, Virginia, or in Sarasota, Florida, or in Timbuktu think about it when there are two groups of Christadelphians, in some instances, who won't even talk to each other? Now, I'm very happy to say that that's not as bad as it used to be. And I'm personally convinced, and this is one individual, one brother saying this, that I believe the hand of God is working in this proposition. But if we are a lot, and I'm emphasizing lot, if we are a lot, we will pay the consequences, even as Lot paid the consequences. And I think you'll see what I mean in just a moment. In just a moment. Well, remember that Abraham handled this heartrending situation confronting him. In verse 8, he manifested a cool and condescending spirit. He had command of his passion, could turn away from wrath with a soft answer. Oh, that we could do that. A soft answer turneth away wrath. Oh, is that hard to do? Speaking from personal experience, I can tell you it certainly is. And yet that's precisely what Abraham did. And a tremendous lesson for us. He, Abraham, was willing to beseech even his inferior to be at peace and to make the first overture of reconciliation. It was not Lot that did it. It was Abraham. Reminded Lot, he says, we are brethren, men of the same nature, of the same kindred and family, of the same religion. What Abraham was professing is that which we must constantly struggle for, the consideration of our relationship to each other as brethren. And when I use that term, sisters, it's a generic term. When I say brethren, it includes sisters. As brethren, we should always prevail to moderate our passions and thus either prevent or put an end to our contentions. Tough, tough, tough. Needful, needful, needful. So Abraham graciously gives Lot his choice. We're told that in verse 9. He says, take your choice. I'll take the leavings. How many of us would do that? But that's what Abraham did. There certainly was every human reason why Abraham should have chosen first, but he in no wise attempts to pursue that right. He was the one who was up here, and he condescended to his inferior. He made the offer. Now, we might say, well, God put that in his mind. I don't believe that for a moment. I think what God had done was to recognize Abraham's heart and what kind of a person he was. And Abraham responded because he had that kind of heart and compassion. But that, again, is my opinion. It's intriguing, I believe, that it wasn't. And here, I think, is the bottom line proof. It wasn't until after Lot was separated from him that God renewed and ratified the promise. Have you ever thought about that? Maybe some of you have. For those of you who haven't, let's read it. Genesis chapter 13, verses 14 through 17. I know you're familiar with the scripture, but the chronology is very important. The Lord said to Abram after Lot had separated from him, "Lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward, for all the land which you see I will give to you and to your descendants forever." "I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if one can count the dust of the earth, your descendants also shall be counted. Arise, walk through the length and the breadth of the land, for I will give it to you." You know, that's the first time that statement was made. Hoy said earlier, "I'll show you a land," but that's the first time he said, "I'm going to give it to you." And it was after Lot had gone. It was after Abraham's humble and self-denying condescension to Lot to preserve the peace that God came to him with this token of his favor. When Abraham had willingly offered Lot half of his right, God came and confirmed the whole of it to him. Not just the half that was left over, but the whole of it. The length and the breadth of the land, "I will give it thee." After Lot had left, he had lost the companionship of his kinsmen, by whose departure his hands were certainly weakened, and I strongly suggest his heart saddened. Then it was that God came to him with these words of comfort. After Lot had chosen the pleasant, fruitful land and had gone to possess it, God comes and assures Abraham that what he had would remain to him and to his heirs forever. For the moment, perhaps, Lot had the better land. But Abraham, the better title. He had the promise. He had the promise. And we hang everything in terms of our belief in the absorbed truth on that promise to Abraham. But it was after Lot had departed. Final observation on the separation from Lot. I suggest that it was a complete separation. In Genesis 15, the first three verses, and we won't turn it up, it supports the total ignoring of his nephew. Remember what Abraham said about the heir in his house? Who was it? Eliezer of Damascus, right? Well, Lot. He said, "The heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus." That's a strong suggestion. The Lot was now out of the equation. Because that was after what we just read in the 14th chapter. We know that Abraham rescued Lot in the War of the Kings in chapter 14. There's no argument there. And later on interceded for him when the angels destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. But there is absolutely no indication that they ever lived together again as before the separation. You can't find it. It doesn't exist in the scriptures. Now the third crisis. sort of gets tougher. The third of the four major crises, subvert your desires concerning your natural firstborn. Subvert your desires concerning your natural firstborn. Let's look at Genesis 17 for a few verses before we move on with this. 17th chapter, and you notice the chronology. We're moving on in Genesis here. Verses 4 through 6. We read this. God to Abraham, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be the father of a multitude of nations. Watch that word, nations, plural. No longer shall your name be Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you the father of a multitude of nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come forth from you. Drop down to the 17th verse. And we read for a couple of verses here. It says, then Abraham fell on his face and laughed. You say, now, whoa, what's the connection here? Well, hold on. It says, Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said to himself, shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? Shall Sarah, who's 90 years old, bear a child? And Abraham said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live in thy sight. The next verse, verse 19. God said, no, but Sarah your wife shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for the descendants after him. Well now, there was a gap between those verses, wasn't there? On purpose. On purpose. We look at this occasion. Let's very carefully weigh the chronology of the events. Now, I know our students back there at that table know what the word chronology means. One, two, three, four. One thing following another, right? When we talk about a chronological series. In verses 4, 5, and 6, I want you to note that the definite plural is used in every verse. Verse 4, many nations, plural. Verse 5, many nations. Verse 6, nations. Not singular, but plural in each instance. So hearing God's declaration up to this point, Abraham, now watch this carefully, brothers and sisters, Abraham had every good reason to think positively and hopefully about Ishmael. For after all, he had then only one son, and Ishmael was it. Right? Now we move on to verses 7 through 14. We find the covenant of circumcision spelled out with every man child, current and forthcoming. Excuse me. While I'm coughing, read verses 7 through 14. Go ahead.
And I will establish my covenant between me and thee, and thy seed after thee in their generations, for an everlasting covenant, to be a God unto thee and to thy seed after thee. And I will give unto thee and to thy seed after thee the land wherein thou art a stranger, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. And God said unto Abraham, thou shalt keep my covenant, therefore thou and thy seed after thee in their generations, This is my covenant which ye shall keep between me and you, and thy seed after thee. Every man child among you shall be circumcised, and ye shall circumcise the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be a token of the covenant betwixt me and you. And he that is 8 days old shall be circumcised among you. Every man child part in the house or bought with money of a stranger which is not of thy seed. He that is born in thy house, and he that is bought with thy money, must needs be circumcised. And my covenant shall be in your flesh for an everlasting covenant. The uncircumcised man-child, whose flesh and his foreskin is not circumcised, that soul shall be cut off from his people. He hath broken my covenant.
Now that dealt with the current and the forthcoming generations. They were included there. Thank you, Chuck. But did you notice that there was still not one word that Ishmael was to take second place? Not there. It wasn't until verses 15 and 16 that the bombshell, as it were, fell on Abraham. Verses 15 and 16. We've read it. God said, Sarah, your wife, shall have a son. I'll not call her name Sarai. Wait a minute, I want to make sure. That's when the name was changed. I will bless her, and moreover, I will give you a son by her. I will bless her, and she shall be the mother of nations. Kings of people shall come out from her. And then Abraham fell on his face and laughed. It was after the covenant. Now think about that for just a moment. We have a situation where, and by the way, this is a very important thing for those teaching the truth, as we all try to do. Abraham never broke that covenant. These so-called protestations of religious people say the Jews are not involved because they broke the covenant. Balderdash. That covenant was between Abraham and God. And Abraham never broke it. Isaac never broke it. And Jacob never broke it. The rebellious children of Israel, the Jews, have destroyed that in many, many instances for themselves, but the promise made to their fathers is still absolute, never been broken. But that's just an aside. Just an aside. We want you to understand, please, that Abraham was shook up. His firstborn Ishmael was supplanted by what God told him about Sarah and his son. Abraham laughed for two reasons. First of all, Ishmael had been born of Hagar. That was Sarah's desire, that was Abraham's desire. And it had been completed. And here comes God saying, well, now wait a minute, Abraham. You are going to have a son by Sarah. You know something? You'd laugh too. But that's only half of it. The other half is that Abraham loved Ishmael. And all of his desires and thought processes were toward that son being the recipient of the ultimate promise. Not Isaac. Because Isaac wasn't even in the equation. And that's why Abraham laughed about it. Are you kidding me? I'm an old man, and my wife is advanced in years. She's going to have a son? So he laughed. Now you know, brothers and sisters, there's little doubt that God has revealed to his people and his purpose, the purpose of his will, by degrees. He didn't jump in this instance and tell Abraham, now look, you're going to have an heir by the name of Isaac and it's going to be born through Sarah. Forget Ishmael. That's not what he said. He made that covenant with Abraham, and Abraham was convinced that his firstborn was the process by which this would happen. And he laughed out loud when God reversed his thinking. So God's will was revealed by degrees, even to Father Abraham. God had told Abraham long before, in the 15th chapter, verse 4, when we were talking about Eliezer of Damascus, he told him long before that he should have a son, but never until right now that he should have a son by Sarah. Ever considered that? Abraham was convinced that having Ishmael was the fulfillment of that promise in chapter 15. That's why he left. Couldn't be. Couldn't be. Now in verse 17, he is all but incredulous. I've read it to you already. And it's very humanly understandable that he reacted the way he did in verse 18. Oh, why not Ishmael? What are you telling me? Ishmael's here. He's real. Isaac hadn't been born. And Abraham pleads for Ishmael. This wrenching experience for Father Abraham was immediately put into God's perspective in verses 19 and 20. And we read this way. God said, no, but Sarah your wife shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. As for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I will bless him and make him fruitful and multiply him exceedingly. He shall be the father of 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. God puts it into perspective. He says, now wait a minute, Abraham. I've told you that Sarah's son shall be thus and so. But I'm not ignoring Ishmael. I'll make him a great nation. Now, if I might digress for just a moment, you know and I know, that's precisely what we see in bold block letters right now. There's no question that the descendants of Ishmael and Esau became great, quote, in their own right, but not as part of the covenant. How many of you happened to see? I didn't. I wish I had. How many of you happened to see the program just last week called Ishmael and Isaac? It was on one of the major networks, and I kicked myself for not having watched it. I think it was on that program called The West Wing.
Yeah.
It was. I never watched that, but that's where I think it was. I don't know what the outcome of that particular program was, but today there are those who recognize that conflict. We've known it ever since we've known the truth. We know why it's there, and we know the ultimate outcome, what it will be. But you see, God told Abraham that Ishmael would not be ignored. Not the covenant, but he would not be ignored. And later on, when you get to Jacob and Esau, basically the same thing is put forth. So there's no doubt, and we've got to be very watchful, and it goes right back to what we just read. We've got to be very watchful in terms of how the final conflict is developed in the Middle East. I have strongly believed and have suggested to those who would listen, and that's all I'm doing, that in the ultimate, when our Lord and Master returns and the kingdom is established, that the first ethnic group of people to recognize Jesus Christ will be the Arabs. sworn enemies right now, and you see the result. And we knew that was going to happen. We're told that that was going to be the case. But at the return of Christ, the descendants of Ishmael, I believe, I may be dead wrong, but I believe they will be the first ethnic and, quote, religious group to recognize the legitimacy of Jesus of Nazareth, as opposed to the Western world, who are steeped in Christian theology, not truth. Now, it remains to be seen. I just expressed with you an opinion on that. Another quick digression, and I think it's worth looking at. No doubt Abraham had a momentary desire and plea that God's will be fulfilled through Ishmael, but just as quickly and completely he accepted God's appointed way through Isaac. We must learn this principle, hard as it is. We must learn this principle as did David. Now, I'm not going to turn these references up because of the time frame. I'm looking at mountain time. No, central time. Central mountain time. How's that? But you recall a situation where David got downright angry with God when Uzzah put his hand on the cart to keep it from turning over. We're told that he got angry with God. But it wasn't very long after that that in effect he says, oh boy, did I blow it. Let me tell you, God said that that ark was to be carried this way, and only this way. So David learned his lesson. He learned his lesson. It's hard for us sometimes to do that. It puts me in mind of the oft-stated axiom. When we pray to God for something or purpose, his answer may very well be no. Now, finally, crisis number four. Take now thy son, thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest, offer him for a burnt offering. Now, I don't want to overdo this, brothers and sisters, for it has been dealt with many times and in many ways. A few observations, however, that may be pertinent for us who would endure to the end. Genesis 22. Remember our chronology? Now we're looking at Genesis 22. What does it say in the first two verses? Genesis 22, verses 1 and 2. Now, here again, Brother Tom and I were discussing at the break, and I completely agree with him. There's nothing in here that's put in there accidentally. And even this phrase, which I'm going to call your attention to, is one of those examples. It says, after these things God tested... What? It says, after these things God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham! And he said, here am I. He said, take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I shall tell you. After these things, how old do you think Abraham was when this statement was made to him? He was an old man. It's hard to prove this, but there are indications that there's some validity to it, that Isaac probably was about 40 years old when this happened. So that would have made Abraham, if that theory is correct, at least 140. We know that Isaac wasn't a toddler. Highly unlikely that he was a teenager. He was probably a young man. But that's something you can take care of in your own thought process. After these things, after everything Abraham had thus far gone through, heartbreaks and joy, the difficulties and trials of much more than 100 years, and I suggest that he may have been as much as 140 years old, perhaps Abraham was justified in thinking that all of the storms had blown over. Boy, I'm finally on the downhill. But now comes the sharpest pang yet. God appears to him just as he did in the first verse of chapter 15 and the first verse of chapter 17. So I'm sure we would be inclined to think that Abraham in all likelihood might have anticipated a renewal of the promise, as had before been the case. But instead, Abraham, go kill thy beloved son. Your bullocks and your lambs won't do. No servant of your household. Ishmael had just recently been cast out, to the grief of Abraham. He didn't appreciate that or like it at all. Isaac only was left. And must he go too? The son whom thou lovest. It was an ultimate trial of Abraham's love to God. Therefore, it must be the beloved son. Ever consider that the place of sacrifice was 3 days' journey? Told where to go, Moriah. It was 3 days' journey from where Abraham and Isaac lived. 3 days' time to consider the deed. And if he did it, it might be deliberate and thought out. Have you considered the manner? Have you even thought about the manner of this killing your son? Not just kill, but offer him for a burnt offering. Kill him devoutly. Kill him by rule. Kill him with the ceremony, the sedateness, and the composure of mind with which he had many times offered his burnt offerings. Because God told him, take him for a burnt offering. The rules were already set out. Abraham knew what a burnt offering involved. And he had to ponder this for 3 days as he was taking him to Moriah. What a test! Tears at your very heart. And you know it tore at his. Now, a very important point, brothers and sisters. Aside from marveling at the tremendous example of faith that Abraham manifested, is this point. God gave him no reason for it. Look until you're blue in the face, and you will not find God telling Abraham why he must do this. Shocks you to your toenails. Do it, but I'm not going to tell you why. A test of faith. I can't get over it when I think about it. When Ishmael was cast out, God gave him a reason for it that satisfied Abraham. But Isaac, if he had to die a martyr for the truth, or a ransom for some other person, or as a criminal, or as an idolater, or as a rebel against God, it might have passed as justice. Beloved son, how would Abraham ever look Sarah in the face again? It would be likely not only to alienate her affections forever for him, but from his God. What would the Egyptians say? The Canaanites and the Perizzites? It would be a reproach unanswerable to Abraham and his altars to Yahweh. These and other objections could well have framed Abraham's refusal to obey. But no, he was assured that it was a command of God, that he was commanded of God. It was no delusion. and this was sufficient to answer any and all objections. So, remember the patterns of the past, our prologue. So, when we view calamities, that's the word I want, calamities about us and around us, when we prayerfully seek reasons for this or that unhappy circumstance and have no apparent answer from God or His Word, we must always remember that God's commands are not to be disputed but obeyed, and that His will be done. When we are tried and tired, and every one of us fit that description at one time or another, maybe many times, when we're tired and tried in the elements of this life, when we're pushed to the brink, when we suffer feelings of hopelessness and helplessness, when those things dearest to us in this life seem to come apart, our reflection with the Father of the faithful might just be our salvation.